Gary Parish, it's Thursday, September 19, 2019. Welcome back to the CBS Sports Eye on College Basketball podcast, where we sometimes discuss camel fighting. And Leaky Black, Matt Norlander, is here with me, and we are now deep into recruiting season. Coaches bouncing around the country, prospects taking visits, publicly pledging their allegiances to various universities. So I want to start with some recruiting news from the past week, and I want to start with a couple five-star guys making commitments to five-star programs. Five-star guard Terrence Clark, he committed to Kentucky this past weekend. He's ranked fourth in the class of 2020 after announcing that he's reclassifying from 2021 to 2020. In other words, he was a junior, but now he is essentially a senior. So that happened over the weekend. Then on Wednesday, DJ Stewart, a five-star guard, committed to Duke. He's ranked 26th in the class of 2020, and the byproduct of those two recruiting developments is that, surprise, surprise, Kentucky and Duke currently have the number one and number two ranked recruiting classes in the country. And if this holds, they will finish first and second in the recruiting rankings for the sixth time in the past 7 years. The only miss was this past year, but the circumstances that led to that, that snapped that streak, were so unique. Obviously, it involves Penny Hardaway getting the job at Memphis in the same year when three of his former Team Penny players were about to be seniors in high school, most notably the nation's number one prospect, James Wiseman. So four of the seven players in Memphis' top-ranked recruiting class, they were actually like top 115 prospects from the Memphis area. So Penny was set up to kill it when he got the job. It's partly why he got the job when he did. I'm not sure anybody expected him to actually land the number one class above Duke and Kentucky, but the circumstances were of such that it was clearly going to be possible. So the class of 2019 rankings were Memphis, Kentucky, Duke in that order. But now we're back to normal. Duke and Kentucky back at the top. And so here's my question for you, Norlander.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Why is it that Duke and Kentucky get the best classes basically every year? They're not the only two places where you can compete for national titles or play for a Hall of Fame coach or play in a great conference or prepare for the NBA or be on television or play in front of monster crowds or travel in a first-class way. You can do all of those things, or at least most of those things, at lots of different places, and yet it's Duke and Kentucky at the top of the recruiting rankings basically every year. Why?
Because if you look at GP, I don't have the numbers right in front of me here, because you sprang this question on me unexpectedly, which is what I like on this podcast. Keep it improvised. My guess is now we have a system that is reinforcing itself. And by that, I mean, for sure, by far, Kentucky has the most NBA picks since Cal got to Kentucky and the most lottery picks. So if you are a top 50 level talent that's going to commit to a school, and top 50 level talents, if you don't even, you know, upgrade that top 25, five stars, purely five star kind of guys, the odds are more likely than not that any other school in the country, Kentucky is the place that will get you drafted as soon as possible in the best possible position. There are exceptions to that. Generally speaking, that can't be overstated. I'll also include that Kentucky, when you go there, when you see how much the fan base cares and is committed, and if you are the kind of five-star prospect that is endlessly devoted basketball to who you are as a person. I'm not just talking about the games and the practices. I'm talking about workouts. You think about it. It is almost all you think about. And then you go to a place like Lexington, Kentucky for officials and unofficial visits, and you see how the program is treated there, how the fan base regards Calipari and its players. I think that is something that is tough to overcome for a lot of schools outside of that. So from the Kentucky angle, I think it's pretty easy. Calipari is the greatest recruiter in the history of the game, in my estimation. He's in the perfect spot. He's the perfect coach at the perfect program and entered in at the perfect time of his career and really the perfect moment for that program to need someone like Cal to take it over. I think it's been a perfect confluence of events over the past 10 years. You know, minor letdowns of not winning national championships aside. That's a totally other discussion, which we've had before and I'm sure we'll have again, but not now. As for Duke, you are dealing with the greatest coach, arguably, in the history of basketball, not just college basketball. There can be a real case to be made for Mike Krzyzewski as the greatest coach in the history of the game. And when you have someone of that kind of stature, like Calipari, an active Hall of Famer, Duke is the most popular brand, if you want to call it that, polarizing, sure, as well, has been sending guys with regularity. And in the past 10 to 15 years, maybe more 10 years or so, you'll recall, GP, that although, like, you know, Grant Hill and potentially Carlos Boozer, Shane Battier, they were seen as like these sort of exceptions. The knock used to be that you went to Duke, you were awesome in college. In the NBA, though, there was no real, you know, security guarantee that you were going to have the same kind of success. You can look at recent players that have gone to Duke and that you can say, well, the pattern's continued. But by and large, you have seen how more players have gone to the NBA at Duke over the past 7 to 10 years and had more success, been drafted higher than they once were. And I think that has caught on as well. And once you get to a certain point, and it's really just really only been Duke and Kentucky. Arizona's been close. If you look at the past 10 years worth of recruiting, Arizona and Sean Miller have been close in many years. And in fact, you know, finished third right there. Memphis now enters as a real player. We'll see what happens in the next year or two with the local talent there and what Penny can do nationally. But it has been Duke and Kentucky that have separated themselves because of the coaches, because of the visibility of the programs. I think that can't be understated as well. It's not as though North Carolina, UCLA, and Kansas and these programs don't also get that kind of attention. But if you were to step back and put yourselves in the shoes of a 16 or 17-year-old Parrish and watch as the season plays out, from things that you can read on your phone to what they see most notably on television to podcast coverage or whatever, it's undeniable that Duke and Kentucky receive more discussion and publicity and marketing than any other program in the sport. So those are my big tent overarching takeaways. I'd be curious if you have anything else, I'm sure you do, as to why that's happened. But I think it's just so hard to fight against that at this point. My last thing, and this might be what you're getting to as well, it's not as though other programs don't benefit from this, but with the exception of maybe Carolina with the Jordan brand and Oregon with Nike, you can't convince me that no other two programs have as much infrastructure backing behind them the way that Nike supports both Kentucky and Duke.
I agree with – I think everything you said, it plays into it to some level. And we should point out, because I know there's some fans out there screaming, why do Duke and Kentucky have the top-ranked recruiting classes almost every year? It's because of Nike. Idiots, have you not paid attention to the wiretaps and text messages? And I'm not going to minimize the role that Nike presumably plays in aiding some of its biggest brands. As we've said, and I think you and I both agree on this, whatever Adidas officials were caught doing, it's not unique to Adidas officials. They might have been sloppier than they should have been, a little more reckless than they should have been. They're the ones that got caught, obviously, but I don't think the Adidas officials invented funneling money, resources to people in exchange for getting prospects to enroll at Adidas schools. I think Nike has done similar things for years, and I think Under Armour has done similar things. And so I'm not dismissive of that. But I also don't think it's just that Nike is, you know, pulling the strings as a puppet master and making sure you know, Duke and Kentucky are taken care of year after year after year. I don't think it's as simple as that, even if some people might try to suggest it. I think everything you said, like I said, plays a role. I think the first thing you said is the biggest thing, and that's that we've reached a point where it's almost feeding itself, where because the best players in the country year in and year out go to Duke and Kentucky, it actually makes the next group of best players in the country want to go to Duke and Kentucky. I think the past success, the recent past success, has really, really helps them in the present day. And I guess this is because I was thinking through it, and I was trying to make sense of it. Like, why is it that a high school senior right now wants to go to Duke or Kentucky over any other brand, even if he's being recruited at a high level by other big brands? And the best thing I can come up with is that, you know, besides all the obvious things that we've talked about, is that we've reached a point where if you are, quote, committed to Kentucky or committed to Duke, it's almost like a label, like a status symbol, like it says something about you. It suggests excellence, because year in and year out, that is where the best prospects tend to go. I would relate it to when I was around that age. I was not a prospect in any sport of any kind of this level. So let me make that clear. But I there was a soccer club that was started. It basically took all of the competitive teams my age and made it into one. So like if there were three high-level club teams, soccer teams in my age group, we merged them, and it became Memphis Football Club. And I grew up in North Mississippi, a suburb of Memphis, and I was the only Mississippi school soccer. I would warm up in a Memphis Football Club practice jersey. Like it said Memphis FC on it. And I don't know that I recognized why I was doing it at the time, but looking back on it, I think I really like the idea that just me being in possession of this thing, it says something about me that I'm different than everybody else on this field. Nobody else was pursued by Memphis Football Club. Nobody else plays for Memphis Football Club. This suggests excellence, or that I'm just a level above everybody else. And then I'd go out and score a hat trick because I really was good. But I wonder now if Duke and Kentucky, on a much obviously bigger stage and level, if it's almost the same thing. Like when you commit to Duke, it says something about you. Like, you know, when you're a high major prospect, that independently says something about you. But it's like, ooh, that's somebody Duke wants.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's somebody Kentucky wants. And I think that teenagers now have, you know, very much subscribe to that. You know, when you see when you get an offer from Duke, like there are kids out there right now who get offers from Kansas and Louisville and Michigan State and other amazing programs. For whatever reason, as the kids say, it hits different when it's Duke. It hits different when it's Kentucky. And I think the fact that they have strung together elite classes featuring elite prospects year after year after year helps them in this way, because when you commit to Duke, it's a headline and a status symbol that it otherwise would not be. Same thing when you commit to Kentucky. Any of that true to you?
Most of that is true. And I think college football had this, and maybe still does to a certain extent, but particularly I think for this went on longer than maybe it should have with Notre Dame kids. If you were recruited by like Notre Dame, I remember hearing back in the day that if a kid was regarded as a certain level and then Notre Dame started looking, maybe he gets elevated a little bit more. That doesn't happen so much in basketball, I think, because of the way that the recruiting is set up and how these kids, when their talents are identified as elite talents, 14, 15 years old, you rarely see a player because, in fact, almost never, I think the recruiting experts that cover the field do a pretty good job and, broadly speaking, are fairly accurate when it comes to this stuff. Sure, you're not going to see a Ja Morant. That's to be expected and all that, but you don't see a player that's, say, a three-star that goes to a five-star over, you know, a two-month span. That almost never happens. And if it does, it's usually not because, hey, now this kid's being specifically targeted by Duke or Kentucky. I don't think that the system is set up this way. But, GP, here's what I want to throw back at you. So I was, as you were talking before, I was looking at football. And because in recent years, obviously, Clemson has come to be right there with Alabama. What we have in Duke and Kentucky in college basketball, we have with Clemson and Alabama in college football, although they don't necessarily align the same ways because, a little to my surprise, Clemson actually has not been finishing atop the recruiting rankings the way that Duke and Kentucky have. Clemson in a given year might be a little bit further back. But aside from that, check this out. And then I got my question for you, and then see if you can, if there's even a program in college basketball that you think applies. So for the past, you know, 7-8 years, Clemson's been extremely good. Won national championships two of the past 3 years, been to the final, been to the college football playoff final three of the past 4 years. But from 1994, GP, until, let's run it up until 2011, Clemson did not finish the season ranked in 12 of those seasons. Had a year in which it won only five games. That was 94. 98 won only three. Had a lot of seven-win seasons, six-win seasons, even 8-5, 7-6. It was just kind of there as a program, right? But given where it was located and its conference, even though the ACC in football has never been the SEC, and I get all of that, I don't know if it was necessarily a sleeping giant, but it was a proud program that just kept running up against the wall for one reason or another. Couldn't quite get there with Tommy Bowden, Tommy West before that, Ken Hatfield, et cetera, et cetera. And they hired the right guy in Dabo Sweeney, and now it's a machine. You've got arguably the best quarterback prospect playing at that program in decades. Just great player after great player. Dabo can go into the South wherever he wants and pluck all these players. So my question for you, GP, is this. As we talked about Kentucky and Duke being 1-2 in the rankings, is there any potential for any other program that's in a similar spot that Clemson was a decade ago to even have any chance to even enter the conversation? And I would apply that criteria, GP, to be a program that regionally cares and a school that cares about college basketball is maybe underperforming, and if it gets the right kind of hire, can do that, say, from now, between now and 4 or 5 years from now. Do you think that there's a school that is positioned to do that? Because I have one potential nominee, but I'm curious to think if there's anyone that could apply in that situation.
Sure. I mean, I think there's no obvious reason why Arkansas couldn't return to that if Must like hit it out of the park. I mean, it was once a nationally, consistently nationally relevant, operating at the top of the sport program that has an incredible fan base, a passionate fan base, and all of the resources to operate at the top level of the sport. So I know it's been a long time since Arkansas has been great, but I could certainly see Arkansas being great again, sure.
Yeah, I could see Arkansas being great again. I can't see Arkansas rising to the level where it's getting top five classes annually. The only school that I think that it would apply here, and it's not an easy parallel, GP, is, and the coach has never proven to be able to do this yet, so we have to see if this is possible. If it's not this coach, maybe it's the next one. Given its location, its conference, its history, its appeal, its standing with the shoe company it's aligned itself with over a long-term contract, if you get the right pieces in place, There is almost, and the Bruins fans are going to be like, thank you, I've been screaming this for a decade. There's really no reason why, well, there's not no reason why. I understand getting in at admissions can be an issue, but UCLA should be vying for top five classes annually. You go to that campus, a lot of this stuff can be sometimes parish. Like a lot, I get it. So many facilities are great these days. Campuses are beautiful. You go to that campus, and if that program is rolling, would you agree? And not even, like, ignore the California bill stuff that's coming down the pike, right? It's hard to fathom how UCLA is not in that number 3 to number 7 class range every single year, given what's there and what should have been provided in recent years by the athletic department. Perhaps they can get it done with Mick Cronin, but UCLA would be my answer to, if you wanted to look up in 3 to 5 years and see a school that was finally, like, vying there, it's like, yeah, that makes sense. That's like almost like the Clemson parallel in football. To me, it would be UCLA.
I don't know why everybody doesn't go to UCLA for any sport. I don't know why UCLA is not awesome at everything.
It's an incredible place.
It's an incredible place. You got a beautiful campus and one of the most significant cities in our country. Amazing weather. Like, there's a reason all of the famous rich people live there. It's because it's an amazing place to live. Like, I'm confused by the idea that UCLA isn't awesome in literally everything.
I get you. But it is fascinating. And maybe this goes to the center of the psyche of the UCLA tortured fan base. And I don't want to say an inferiority complex because they don't have that. But yeah, it's got to be frustrating when you look at the history of that program and how it just from you say it in everything, no doubt about it, but specifically in men's basketball. And perhaps they'll get it rolling in a really strong way with Mick Cronin. They obviously have arguably the best freshman point guard coming into the sport next year in Dacian Nix. But that would be the one that I'd be waiting on. But I don't think that while Kay and Calipari are working at Duke and Kentucky, that maybe Penny, GP. But really, if you told me that one of these schools will be in the top two every single year until they retire. I'd believe it. I'd say it's actually weirdly more likely than not to happen because we've hit this. This is an era, and it will continue to go on until those guys step down. And I would expect Kay to do that before Cal.
Yeah, to me, and I think another contributing factor is the roster turnover. You know, they really don't have to worry. You know, as we circle this back to Duke and Kentucky recruiting, they don't have to worry about usually having this amazing sophomore point guard who is going to prevent the next, five-star point guard from enrolling, because it's almost understood at this point. We're going to have we're starting fresh basically every year. I know Trey Jones would be an exception to this. At Duke, and honestly, that could have been the thing that cost them Boogie Ellis, that helped Memphis get the number one recruiting class in America, the return of Trey Jones. But Kentucky and Duke are able to consistently go out and get the next great things because their rosters are, like, the playing time's available. You know, Zion ain't coming back. RJ ain't coming back. You know, the kids at Kentucky, largely, you know, the top shelf guys, they're going to only be on campus for a year. And so you don't really have to worry about the possibility of getting stuck in a numbers game and being, you know, on the bench at the end of a rotation, because, you know, the roster starts fresh nearly every year. So I think that's a contributing factor as well. But I do think it's super interesting that, you know, like, we can compare it to the football rankings, and usually, like, the same schools are going to be at the top, but it's not going to be the same two in the top two basically every year. And yet that is what we've got with Kentucky and Duke, you know, with the exception of this past year. And the explanation for that, I think, is pretty obvious. We went through it. I really do think that it's become a status symbol to say, I'm going to Duke or I'm going to Kentucky, and that kids are like anybody else who buys a Mercedes or, you know, has a Louis Vuitton bag. Like, being a Duke commit or a Kentucky commit registers differently than I do think anywhere else in the country, even if there are other blue bloods, other consistent championship contenders, and other Hall of Fame coaches. The status symbol of being a Duke recruit or a Kentucky recruit is different than, I think, any other status symbol. And I believe it aids Duke and Kentucky in recruiting.
So I agree with that. And I think particularly as it speaks to Duke, GP.
Let me make this point, because it's okay. It's something I noticed that's sort of under the same umbrella. You and I were at USA Basketball back, I guess, late July. And Kennedy Chandler was there. He's a young man who lives here where I live. He goes to Bradcrest Christian School. And he's an interesting story because he's been like a top 75 player throughout high school in his high school class. He's a class of 2021 kid. But he was on Mocan Elite, was the point guard there, helped them. I don't want to say led, but helped them. Maybe led. He was awesome in the championship game to a Peach Jam title. Gets invited to USA Basketball, really performs there. And now he's a five-star point guard in the class of 2021. He's basically in everybody's top 20, 25 now. He's probably improved his status as much as anybody in the class of 2021 over the past, say, 6 months. I should point out he also won a Tennessee State Championship, you know, was the MVP of it, in, I believe, as a sophomore in high school this past year. So it's been an amazing run. So then he gets back, you know, summer's over. He's back in school, and I actually had him come in studio with me and hang out for, you know, 20 minutes or so one day. And he was wearing a USA Basketball shirt. And then the other day he had an open gym, and there were coaches there, obviously, to see him, and news cameras there. And so I saw it on the local news. He's wearing a USA Basketball shirt.
Yeah.
Because that USA Basketball, now, I'm assuming it's not the most comfortable shirt he has or the only shirt
it might
he has,
be.
But that you, like, USA, it says something about you. Like, I am USA Basketball. And so he, like, you walk around very proudly, you know, wearing that, not just because it's a cool shirt, but because it says who I am.
Yes.
It says how good I am. And I think, again, I am committed to Duke. I am committed to Kentucky. Nobody has to guess how good you are. If you are committed to Duke or Kentucky, it is now established. You must be exceptional. And I think that feeds it just, I think it aids the recruiting process, feeds itself year after year after year.
It does. The USA basketball thing is for real in terms of how that organization has made it a desirable thing for 15, 16, 17, 18, 19-year-olds. You know, I know that they're, you know, the team that just lost overseas and finished, what, seventh place or whatever, it's a disaster. I get all that. But at the younger levels, we see that at Peach Jam, you see the kids in their warm-up gear after the game. They either have their USA basketball backpack on, they got the USA basketball gear. It is very much a status symbol in the ways that you were talking with about with Duke and Kentucky, which is good. It can have potential negative effects if you don't wind up living up to that, you know, expectation and that status symbol, if you will, when you get to college, but that's column A and column B. GP, what you've talked about with Duke, I think feeds into something that we should hit on with your column this week about the kid that goes to Harvard. So set that up. What, who this player is, why he went to Harvard, why you endorsed the move, and then I'll chime in with the Duke angle on this, because you made a good point about the type of recruit that, because it's Ivy League stuff, just, you know, people tend not to talk about and write about much. But surprisingly enough, we haven't seen more of this, although maybe that's changing.
So I thought it was interesting on Sunday, four-star prospect named, and I'm going to butcher the name. I actually text messaged a couple recruiting analysts a minute ago to like get the proper pronunciation. I just haven't heard back yet. Couldn't find anything on YouTube. Yes, I did look. Justice Ajagbor?
Sounds good to me.
It's something along those lines. He committed to Harvard. He is not a consensus top 100 player in America, but he is a four-star prospect, and he is ranked 60th in the top 247 over at 24/7 Sports. And that makes him, according to our buddy Evan Daniels, the highest-rated prospect ever to commit to Harvard. And he did so despite having multiple offers from traditional high-major programs in traditional power conferences. And I decided to write about it because, A, I just think it's interesting, and B, it is an example of something I've thought should be more seriously considered by talented prospects annually, and that is the Ivy League option. Now, as I point out in the column, if you're a five-star prospect, consensus top 15 player in your class, go wherever you want to go, and because you're probably going to be a one-and-done or two-and-done prospect. That's what history shows. Life's going to work out for you fine no matter what. You're almost certainly not going to do 4 years of college basketball. So why do you want to go to an Ivy League school when you're going to play 2 years of college and then sign a multimillion-dollar contract to play basketball? So, like, I ain't talking about them. Although, if they wanted to, fine with me. What I'm talking about is the guy exactly like this guy, ranked outside of the top 50, but still, you know, obviously talented, but statistically unlikely to ever be an NBA player, because the truth is, though there are examples outside of the top 50 every year that end up in the NBA, you are the likelihood of you getting there if you are ranked outside of the top 50 in your high school class is very, very low. If you're a top 10 player in America, it's very, very high. If you're outside of the top 50, it's very, very low, even if it does happen. As I point out, Steph Curry, Kawhi Leonard, Damian Lillard, all amazing examples of sub-50, even sub-100 prospects coming out of high school who not only made it to the NBA but have become stars in the NBA, but make no mistake, they are the exceptions, nothing close to the rule. So what I thought for a while is that, let's just say if I had a son who was ranked, I don't know, 77th in his high school class. So he's good enough to go to a high major. Probably ain't the type of guy Duke and Kentucky are recruiting, but certainly the type of guy other schools in the ACC or SEC is recruiting. And he's also super smart, and not just super smart, but adequately educated in the sense that his transcript looks the way, and he's coming from the type of school that might allow the Ivy League to be a realistic option. And Tommy Amaker and Steve Donahue and other Ivy League coaches are interested in him. I've long thought that I would really, really ask him to seriously consider the Ivy League option, because here's the truth. You get the best of both worlds. No matter what happens over the next year or two or three or four, you leave college a massive winner. Because though it is true, more NBA prospects come out of Duke and Kentucky than other places, I think that's got way more to do that with Duke and Kentucky recruiting more NBA prospects as opposed to developing NBA prospects, although I don't want to be dismissive of the role John Calipari and Mike Krzyzewski play. But the truth is, like, you can get to the NBA from anywhere. It can be Washington or Weber State. It can be Memphis or Murray State. You can get there from anywhere. So if you are actually good enough, you know, one of the few sub-50 players who develops into a legitimate NBA prospect, no problem. They'll find you at Harvard or any other Ivy League institution or any other institution in this country. But if the more likely scenario plays out, which is you're not an NBA prospect, you're just a talented basketball player who was good enough to go to college and play, but not really much more than that, well, you're still going to be probably the most talented dude on your team, which sounds fun, as opposed to buried on the bench at a high major program. Probably going to be one of the most talented players in your league, which sounds fun, as opposed to a guy coming off the bench in a power conference. And you're going to exit school with a degree from an Ivy League institution. And I submit that if you are entering a post-basketball life, probably the most valuable thing you can take with you is a degree from an Ivy League institution. Now, clearly, you're sacrificing something if you take the path that this young man is taking. You're not going to be playing in the biggest and best arenas. You're not going to be chartering flights. You're not going to be on television every week. You're not going to be playing against the best, in the best conferences year in and year out. Like, I'm not trying to pretend this is apples to apples. You are sacrificing all of those things and other things in exchange for the Ivy League education. But I really do think that if my son were all of the things I've described, I would maybe want him to do exactly what this young man's doing.
Yeah, it's a wonderful goal to have. So why doesn't it happen? Why hasn't it become more of a trend? I think there are a few reasons for it. If you get into a situation where you're a top 50 player, which is not what Justice is, but if you're a top 50, if you're regarded as a universal or near consensus top 50 player, you already, while not Ivy League, and Ivy Leagues are mostly a separate deal here, I'd argue Stanford is essentially just as good. But if the Harvard, Cornell, Columbia, and Yale bros want to come at me over that, feel free. Would not have remotely come close to being accepted into any of these fine institutions. You've got, say, Duke, okay? A Duke education on top of its tradition. That's why we're not going to see it happen at top 50. So you go to that, 51 to 100 or 125 or whatever. Why still has it not been as common as maybe it might be? Parrish just hit on a lot of the stuff that I think is accurate. I think going into those environments, if you're not truly exceedingly academically focused, is not going to lend people to go and play in those. Otherwise, Stanford had it rolling for a long time. Stanford should be getting better. Stanford should be racking in every single top 100 prospect that qualifies. There's similar to UCLA. I've actually never been to the Stanford campus, but I have two friends who attended Stanford and know people who have been there and say, like, you've got it. Just ridiculous. Okay. Absurd. Pat Forty's daughter, our good friend Pat, scholarship swimmer at Stanford. He's like, I remember back when she was still going through the process of being recruited, not sure. And I remember at the time Pat was like, she's going to make her decision, but she better pick Stanford. Like, there's just when Stanford comes to you and wants you to attend that university, you absolutely take it, because it is regarded as the best non-Ivy option out there, with the exception of, say, like an MIT or whatever. So it's still a bit vexing to me that you don't have, say, a Stanford being better. Michigan, extremely strong public university. So I think when you have kids that are going to be qualifying to get into an Ivy, if they're good, if they're that top 100 parish, they're obviously going to be capturing the attention of other extremely good public institutions that can offer scholarships. One thing I don't have fact checked in front of me, GP, and I don't know if you know this or not, but I'm guessing while the Ivies have some nice, it's not scholarship free, so to speak. They do have tremendous financial aid packages at a lot of these Ivy schools, but I don't think the kids at the Ivies get the GP. Why am I blanking on the term? Why am the checks that the players get every year now?
Cost of attendance.
Correct.
Stipend.
Correct. I don't think if you go to an Ivy, you get a cost of attendance. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think you get a cost of attendance if you're 17, 18 years old, and you know, Big Ten cost of attendance is going to be, you know, a check for $4,000. Does that make an impact? I think that it might. Plus, I'm only trying to think of like a 17-year-old GP. Like, it's an incredible opportunity, but it's Ivy League education. It is extremely hard, and the circumstances there for any 17 to 18-year-old student athlete. It's just you got to want to take it on. You got to really want to take it on, which is why I'm always impressed by any Ivy League player, people that go play for West Point, even more so. You play for a military academy. The well-rounded young men and women that are able to do that, so extremely impressive. I'll tag it with all this, GP, though. We'll say this. Tommy Amaker has it rolling and rolling hard as of late. 11 of the best 15 recruits to ever attend Harvard, given the past 20 years worth of a database, which in Harvard's case is totally fair to say. They've all been in the past 4 recruiting cycles. 11 of the top 15. And that doesn't even get into some really good guys from years past like Wesley Saunders. Doesn't get into Jeremy Lin as well. So Harvard's got it going, and a newsflash here, they've got a chance to be like a top 30 program this season. A lot of talent. They're healthy. So as we talk about how they're building for the future, Harvard could be set up for a dynastic run in the Ivy League over the next 3 or 4 years, because it doesn't look like anyone is particularly close this year to the Crimson, and that could be the case next year and the year after.
So when I ask, like, why don't more prospects ranked, say, between 50th and 150th consider an Ivy League option? Like, seriously consider it. We've had some players recently, like, have Harvard on their list. I think Mo Bamba had Harvard on his list.
Wendell but then Carter?
Goes to Texas.
Yeah, yep. Wendell Carter at Duke, right, GP?
Wendell Carter, yeah. Like, had Harvard on his list. I think he even visited, maybe. But ultimately, he goes to Duke. So these guys have considered it, but you know, Justice is the highest rated prospect to ever actually pull the trigger. So when I ask, like, why don't more prospects seriously consider it, it's almost a rhetorical question. The answer, I think, is, and you sort of touched on it, you know, I'm thinking of this from the perspective of a 42-year-old. Often we're asking, you know, we're asking prospects to think of it from the perspective of a 16 or 17-year-old. And though what I'm telling you is true, that if you're ranked outside of the top 50 in your high school class, you are almost certainly not going to make it to the NBA. They don't believe that. They all think they can.
Oh,
because
yeah.
If you're ranked, you know, 75th in the country, it probably means you have been the best player on your high school team, for the best player on every team you've ever played on, or at least, like, if you get into Nike, EYBL, grassroots stuff, top 3 player on, you know, one of the best grassroots teams in the country. There's nothing that's ever happened in your life that makes you think you're not going to achieve what it is you want to achieve from a basketball perspective, even if statistically, if you look at it, the odds are drastically stacked against you. So I think that's the number one thing. Like, why would I go to an Ivy League school if I'm only going to spend 2 years in college? Because they, you know, if you rank 75th in the country, you don't think you're spending 4 years in college. At least most young men don't. That's why this young man is interesting to me and seems to be very self-aware. Like, again, he's ranked 60th in the country according to one recruiting service. And his announcement, I don't know if you saw it, the actual wording of it I thought was interesting. He didn't say, "I'm committing to Harvard." He said, "I have decided to spend the next 4 years playing basketball at Harvard." He's not even talking about leaving school early ever. This is a top 75 prospect. He's like, "I'm going to school for 4 years and I'm going to do it at Harvard." So I think that the idea that nobody thinks they're spending 4 years in college if they're ranked in the top 75 is why more top 75 prospects don't consider this. In addition to, you know, the television, arenas, charters, big brands, basketball brands, as opposed to Ivy League brands, all of that plays a role. I will say that I have you know, when I asked the question on Twitter, why don't more, you know, I set the column up, the responses, largely from people who don't read the column, they just read the tweet. The response was rooted in, well, it's because it's super expensive to go to an Ivy League school, you know, because they, as you point out, do not have athletic scholarships. But that is completely misleading. It's not, and all Ivy League schools are different, but let's just focus on Harvard for a second, because that's where this prospect is attending. Do you realize Harvard is one of the most affordable universities, one of the most affordable college options in the country?
Yeah, with a 0.005 acceptance rate, yes.
Yeah, yes. I mean, you, listen, it's almost impossible to get in there. I think the acceptance rate is 4%, actually.
Yeah. Well, that actually is truly higher than I thought, but maybe not as many teens are shooting their shot. But that's interesting. Anyway, continue.
But once you're admitted, financial aid is available to you. If your family makes less than $65,000 a year, which I know is not a lot of money, but there are some basketball prospects and as well as soccer. There's people that you pay nothing to go to Harvard. If you're accepted, you pay zero. 20% of Harvard students actually pay nothing to go to Harvard. And, you know, if you come from a more affluent background, they have a formula in place. And, you know, you punch in all the numbers and they only ask you to pay what you can afford. So I figured it out. You know, like for a family that like makes good money, really good money, if you send your kid to a private school right now in high school and he were to get accepted to Harvard, you would pay less for him to go to Harvard than you pay for him to go to a good private school in high school, because they don't want people leaving there with incredible student loan debt or any student loan debt.
Yeah.
And so I got one person after another on social media saying, well, you can't get an athletic scholarship and you don't want to come out of Harvard $200,000 in debt. You won't come out of the Harvard $200,000 in debt. It's not only that basketball prospects do not leave Harvard with debt. Students do not leave Harvard with debt. And so that's one of the real misconceptions about Harvard and other Ivy League institutions. It sounds like it's impossible to afford it. But that's not actually a thing. It's impossible to get accepted. But if you're accepted, you're in a good spot.
You are in a good spot. It's the lack of exposure. Again, it's hand in hand what you hit on there, GP, with the top 75 prospect. You ask any player that's ranked in the top 100 in any, they're thinking that they're going to play in the NBA. Many of them, if not most of them, believe that it will not take 4 years worth of experience at the college level to get there too. I think that also is a hindrance. But good on Harvard, man. And that's going to be a good team this year. And a nice column from GP. If you have not read it, it is up obviously at CBSSports.com, or just bring it up on your phone on the CBS Sports app.
All right, before we get out of here, I want to touch on Tony Bennett reportedly turning down a significant raise from Virginia after winning a national championship. But first, check this out.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Jeremy Renner returns to Paramount Plus for a brand new season of the original hit series, Mayor of Kingstown.
My job is to create a balance, avoid a war.
From executive producer Taylor Sheridan, co-creator of Yellowstone.
There's some new players in town, and they brought the flag.
And Antoine Fuqua, director of Training Day.
I know it's always been a war zone, Mike, but this is next level.
The mayor is back in business.
Are you warning me?
You're going to find out.
Mayor of Kingstown. New season streaming June 2nd. Exclusively on Paramount Plus.
So, a story comes out earlier this week that Tony Bennett, after winning the 2019 NCAA tournament, you might have heard, 2018 becomes the first one seed to ever lose to a 16. 2019, national champions. And so, obviously, when you have that kind of success, we live in a world where your bosses can't wait to hand you more money. And so Virginia administrators went to Tony and they offered what has been described as a, quote, substantial raise. And Tony turned it down and asked them to instead take the money and invest it in his staff, take the money and invest it in other program improvements. And, you know, at or around the same time, he and his wife gave pledged $500,000 toward a career development program that's been launched for current and former Virginia players. And I had somebody ask me, like, is this a publicity stunt? And I'm like, what? Like, there's a whole lot of ways to get publicity if you want it. You know, giving away or rejecting substantial amounts of money isn't really the smartest way to go about it. I don't believe it's a publicity stunt. Hell, I don't even think Tony Bennett likes publicity. So, like, he's the last person who would even pull a publicity stunt. I think it's just a reflection of actually who Tony is and how unique he is in this very specific profession, because I don't know how many national championship coaches or high major coaches in general would turn down a substantial raise that the market suggests they deserve. Tony might be in a group by himself on this one.
So you hit on something that was what I was going to say off the top here. How many coaches behind closed doors that are like at that high level? So coaches of like top 25 programs, coaches that in their heart of hearts know they've got a realistic chance of getting to a Final Four in the next, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 years, whatever, being like in a beloved way, or maybe not, being like, this effing guy, are you kidding me? So you're telling me if I win a national championship now, I'm going to look like an a-hole if I don't do this? Tony Bennett's making the rest of the profession look extremely bad. My second thought is, this is a great way to soften the blow for when he's got to say, you know what, I got to bounce, the NBA's calling, I got to leave. They're going to be like, how can we, got us a national championship, turn down this huge raise, put, you know, $500,000 back into the university and its men's basketball program to build out even more for our student athletes. The cynical side of me says, yeah, so when Tony Bennett leaves for the NBA, if in fact that does happen, he's just, you know, he's affording himself even more of a, you know, leverage and comfort room. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it would be not impossible, but incredible if Virginia fans were ever upset with
they
Tony.
Wouldn't be. Yeah, they would.
Yeah, they
be.
Don't think they would be. And you know what? We actually live in a world where fan bases, they get upset if you leave for another school. Like if you leave for if you're at one school that people think
I got the exact example for you, GP.
Go ahead.
Butler fans have zero ill will toward right. Brad Stevens, and they have not gotten over, some of them have not gotten over Holtman leaving for Ohio State.
Well, that's perfect. Like, the point I'm making, and you've just made it, fans get mad when you leave their school for another school. They don't get mad when you leave their school for the NBA. It's almost like that's sort of understandable. That's why I think, you know, it would have been very difficult for Fred Hoiberg to ever leave Iowa State for another school. Like, even if, like, John went to the NBA and Kentucky called, it just, like, the mayor leaving Ames for another college job, how could you do this and break our hearts? But when the Chicago Bulls call, it's like, hey, what are you going to do? They're offering $5 million a year, and it's the Chicago Bulls, it's the NBA. Fred has always dreamed or you know, possibly dreamed of coaching in the NBA. Completely understandable. And then he gets fired, he can bounce back to Nebraska. And I don't know that Iowa State fans are upset that he's the coach at Nebraska. But if he'd have left Iowa State for Nebraska, woo, that'd have been a big deal. And so if Tony ever were to leave for the NBA, and I do think he will someday, I think he will be an NBA coach someday, I don't think Virginia fans would be upset with him at all. And I don't think they'd have any right to be whatsoever.
They wouldn't be. And I think, yeah, Virginia fans are obviously loving the situation they have going. Even like this current upcoming season where Virginia is not considered a Final Four contender. It's Tony Bennett. It's Virginia. Like, even if it's a down season, they accept it because they've got a really good recruiting class set up for the next season as is. And they know they've got it good. So they're almost like, can we just hold on to this guy for dear life for as long as possible? Because at this point, barring the unpredictable, Virginia has reached a level, and you know, maybe they are the true answer for the Clemson parallel I was looking for before. But recruiting wise, it's just not the same. They can't get to a level that I think UCLA can. Anyway, when Tony Bennett's there, Virginia almost every single season is almost likely going to be in the conversation as a top 10 team in a given season. So you hold on to that as long as you can. I don't know for sure Tony will ever leave UVA and go to the pros. I say that, I said what I said before as sort of a half joke, but a half joke, like half serious, like it could happen. And if it does, obviously for UVA fans will begrudgingly accept it. But this was a pretty nice move that I'm sure some coaches are like, now we have to watch who wins next year. And because you're right, if you win a national championship, you're getting a restructure contract, as you should. You win a title, you get a new deal. That's how it should be. And but yeah, and Bennett has reset the market on this, which is just funny in its own way, because I understand if people are thinking that it was like for publicity's sake. You're right. Tony Bennett does not, he's just not like that. He's not one to search for a microphone or a camera. In fact, I'd say he demurs more often than not when it comes to that stuff. And I was actually surprised this was put out the way that it was in terms of just like it being out there. And credit also to his wife, Laurel, because he gave credit to his wife in this decision. I think it was maybe even her suggestion that kind of led it on. But more than anything, I think they put it out there. So it also, frankly, it works as a really strong reinforcement and recruiting tool for the program, just in terms of what they're going to invest in there and how it's being used, the money that he turned down for the benefit of you know, Virginia players and redoing the weight room and all that stuff at JPJ and all that stuff. But yeah, obviously a big dose of positive news for UVA on the heels of a national championship, as it prepares to play a season here, which I don't know what to expect of Virginia. All I know is I did my 50 things to watch GP, posted that column on Monday, and made predictions and for every like major conference, and I almost took Virginia again just out of, I don't know, default habit, but I didn't. But if you told me, like, would you be surprised, Parrish, if Virginia's a 2 seed this year? Would you actually be surprised if that happened?
No, the only way you could be surprised if it happens is if you just don't pay attention to the sport of college basketball. Like, I did all of the numbers on it not too long ago when I was trying to figure out, back in the offseason, I was trying to figure out, like, where do I put Virginia? Because they've obviously lost, you know, if Virginia would have returned everybody eligible to return, they'd have been preseason number one unanimously.
Without a doubt.
I think they lost 3 players to the NBA draft.
Yeah.
And so, okay, like, you know, they that's significant pieces. I think top 3 scores probably.
Yes.
And you start going, okay, well, where should I put them? And you look at the roster, and the roster does not blow you away. But then you look at Tony Bennett's track record, and that absolutely blows you away. Virginia, I'm trying to look it up now, has finished in the top 12 at KenPom in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 consecutive seasons. Does it matter who comes, who goes, who leaves early, who stays longer? They finish in the top 12 year after year after year, regardless of the pieces. That is a testament to Tony. And I'm just going to assume that they'll be right there again. You know, whether it's 6th or 12th, I don't know. Maybe even 14th or 15th, who knows? But the idea that Virginia lost too much to still be one of the very best teams in the country, I disagree with that completely. And the reason is because as long as Virginia's still got that coach, Virginia's going to be good. That's what the track record shows, at least.
Jay Huff Hive, assemble. Jay Huff is going to have a huge junior. That is my prediction. But we'll get to more of those as we dip into October. Last thing, GP, before we wrap up, just did you see this? Like, what? Patino settling with Louisville? And am I correct in this? He gets no money, and simply for the purposes of the record, resigned instead of was fired. Like, this is a massive L for Patino, and I don't think it has any influence one way or the other over if he gets hired again. I remember when he left, I said he's never coaching again, and I have softened on that. You, to your credit, were much more lenient and liberal to the idea that he could return. I don't see this being having any effect whatsoever. Whether he, first of all, everyone knows that he was fired. So even if his record officially shows that he resigned, I think that's immaterial. And he got no money after seeking tens of millions in from damages from Louisville. So I thought that was an interesting outcome for Patino to settle on this. By the way, they came to a settlement. It wasn't like Patino like outright lost via any sort of arbitration or legal court matter. They settled this, and it was just not the outcome I expected Patino to accept.
No, now I didn't understand like why he thought, or why his attorney thought, which is the more likely scenario, I assume, that Louisville would just hand over, you know, millions of dollars in a settlement, because I didn't understand. Like, it seemed pretty clear that if they wanted to fire him, they had reason to do so. If they wanted to stand by him, they could have. But, you know, they enough stuff had happened on his watch where it appeared that he could, you know, reasonably be terminated. And so why Louisville would then just hand over millions of dollars? Unless it just, you know, sometimes it's easier just to settle something than it is to continue to fight it out. Like, that would have been the only explanation from my perspective. But the idea that he would just let it all go simply because, you know, in exchange for you saying I resigned as opposed to being fired is, yeah, I agree, weird. If only, unless, of course, it just got to a point where they said, we're not giving you any money. Like you, not a penny. You know, we did what we were contractually within our rights to do. We don't regret it. And so, like, zero is how much we're going to give. And he says, okay, can you at least do this for me? And they say, okay, fine, we'll do this because we don't even think it matters. Like, maybe that's how this happens. Like, he just reached a point where it was made perfectly clear to him, you will not get a penny. And he said, well, can you give me this thing? And they said, if it'll make you smile, we'll give you this thing. Thank you for your national championships, and here you resigned as opposed to fired. That's the only explanation. But why he thinks that matters at all is strange to me, because, you know, whoever looks at his personnel file, like it doesn't matter. Like, it's he was forced out at Louisville amid scandal. Like, that's the truth of the story, and that'll always be the truth of the story. So yeah, it's kind of bizarre to me.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure Louisville fans are celebrating their athletic director, Vince Tyra, over this. And if just from the Louisville side of it, like, it's a huge win, just not having to pay Patino at all. And I'm sure it's awaiting here, whatever its next battle with the NCAA might be. But to kind of have this be completely now finished in advance of anything else that's coming with the NCAA, just, you know, a little bit of a small headline there, but it was one where I almost did a triple take with the headline and then read the story, and I couldn't believe what happened there. But maybe Patino also didn't want more things to go to Discovery. I don't know. It is interesting, but obviously Patino wants to move on, and I think this now sets the table for him behind the scenes to search for any potential opportunities come March of 2020. I don't know if he'll get it, but I personally believe that Patino will be actively seeking any opportunity to be a head coach at the college level. We'll wait and see what happens if we get scuttlebutt with that. But with this now being done, I think that is his next step from where I sit.
I promise you he will be looking for college opportunities. When he turned down the opportunity to return to Greece, to me, that was an indication that he wants to take a shot at returning to college. Because if you commit to coaching in Greece, you're still coaching in Greece, you know, after the coaching carousel has come and gone. And so the only way to be truly available, you know, next March, April, when college coaches are hired, is to not coach this season professionally in Greece. And so I talked to him about it. He was weighing all of these options, and he decided not to go back to Greece. And he had a lot of different reasons, but I do genuinely believe one of them was, I want to be available next March, April, if somebody is willing to hire me. And I've said it a million times. I still believe it to be true. You know, we this is a sport where Sean Miller is still employed. This is a sport where Will Wade is still employed. The idea that Rick Pitino is unhireable, that's crazy. And I do think somebody will convince themselves of it, perhaps as soon as March or April. Shouts to Devin Downey. Shouts to Chester, South Carolina. Shouts to Terry MF and Teagle. He's a legend. Shouts to Larnell. And please go subscribe to the Eye on College Basketball podcast via Apple Podcasts. You can find it, obviously, anywhere you find podcasts these days. But you can subscribe via Apple Podcasts, rate it favorably, 5 stars, leave a nice comment. That's all I've ever asked. And either way, we're going to talk to you again next week. Till then, take care.
Paramount Plus and the National Park Foundation present A Mountain of Zen. Are you still listening? Good. Take a deep breath. You needed a break. This Earth Week, you can live stream 7 national parks for 7 days on Paramount Plus. So, yes, you can literally stream a stream. Paramount Plus, official streaming partner of the National Park Foundation.